Aleppo, dear friends, I hope you had a wonderful long weekend. Welcome to the 10th session of Dr. Saidi's lecture series. Just a reminder, please turn off all your cell phones. And we'll start, Dr. Saidi.
Today is a very intimate session. most of the usual audience are not here. The topic that I want to begin this session is writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, and this means that for the next definitely two sessions, and probably the next three sessions, will focus on his writings and the relevance of his writings. To begin with the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, today I was struggling a lot choosing what specific aspect or what specific question to focus on. So I came with an idea that I find it very important in terms of its sociological, political, historical relevance. So we would have a schematic overview of some of the aspects of the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá with regard to a very particular question. The question that I want to raise is simply the issue of the East and the West, the relation of East and the West. And this question is part of a general philosophical, sociological question. For example, the question of modernity. What is the nature of modernity and what the non-Western societies should do in regard to modernity? This was the hot topic, the only real political, social question of the 19th century Iran, and to a large extent, the only major question of political, sociological question in the 20th century Iran and many other parts of the world. It's also the question of the nature of our conception of development, of values and the like, namely whether values or definition of development, these are universalistic, objective concepts, or they are completely relativistic and dependent on culture of a particular society. So whether something which is good for all societies universally, or that what is good is defined only in terms of a particular culture, and so what is good for a culture is not good for another culture, and you cannot generalize the concept of development in a transcultural fashion. These are very important social, political questions, and related to all of them, of course, particularly in the context of Iran, is relation of religion to modernity. And that becomes also the question of the relation of the East and the West. So I want to look at the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá in the context of this particular question. And so I'll go to different historical periods, look at varieties of expressions of this issue, and then try to understand the import of wisdom of Abdu'l-Bahá in terms of these questions. So let me start this discussion with a particular approach to this question in Western societies. And then I'll go and concentrate in terms of this question on Iran. In terms of the West, during the time that Abdu'l-Bahá was writing throughout his life, including the time that he came to the United States and he went to Europe and Canada, during those times, a very important, powerful sociological, political theory dealing with the question of East versus the West was varieties of Eurocentric worldviews and ideas, which primarily made a complete distinction between the East and the West. And the idea was that East and the West, they are, each one of them, are one uniform, united entity. So East is one consistent unitary entity, they say East or West?
East.
And the West also is a monolithic entity. It has a unity, a particular soul, a particular reality, one reality it is. And these two are exactly opposites of each other. East and the West are opposite of each other. They have nothing in common with each other. And this unity of the East, of the West, was supposed to be continuous in history. Namely, there is a Western culture and Western society which goes back to at least 2,500 years, and that this unity of identity of the Western culture has remained constant and has been the case throughout these times. And the same is the case about the East. So that unity is also a unity in time. So these cultures were understood as representing a consistent spirit in time and in a space, but they are completely opposite of each other. In the Eurocentric conception of civilization, the idea was that the West is defined by rationality, culture of rationality, and it was traced to the Greek thought. Greek philosophy and Greek culture and Greek civilization was a culture which celebrated reason. And the culture of the West became continuation and embodiment and realization of that one fundamental principle, which ultimately led to modernity. Modernity becomes a culture of reason. And the opposite of that, namely the East, becomes the culture of superstition and irrationality, the culture of bondage, collective bondage of individuals, and the refusal of application of the principle of reason to society, life, culture, and the like. These ideas of the time were accompanied with heavily racist theories, which was partly grounded in the new Darwinian conception of biology and the philosophical interpretations of that biological theory, which then the opposition between the East and the West at the same time became not only a cultural opposition, but also became a racial opposition. And the race became explanation of these different cultural orientations and so on. Already in the writings of Baha'u'llah, in the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, we see direct challenge, of course, of this particular point of view. But before I mention a few points about that, I want to discuss, in the continuation of this discussion, the emergence of a very similar conception in the East. And by the East here, I mean specifically Iran. So lots of my discussions about Iran and the conception of East and the West from the point of view of Iranian intellectuals, Iranian writers, and so on, would focus on two particular time periods, two crucial time periods in the history of Iran. And you'll see that it is really the repetition of that same idea, that Eurocentric idea, in a different way. It becomes, to some extent, reversed. And of course, then the basic content of my talk is how Abdu'l-Bahá represents a totally different viewpoint, and how his viewpoints have been relevant not only for his time, but for the entire 20th century and for 21st century. Okay, just a few points about Baha'u'llah's approach to these questions. Of course, the writings of Baha'u'llah and everything that he has discussed, you know, the concept that you should not look at others as strangers, his emphasis on emergence of an organic culture of humanity, the interdependence of all humanity, the necessity and emphasis on communication and mutual learning of people from different religions, from different ethnicities, from different cultures, and so on. And many are principles of oneness of humanity, peace, and the like, are all different expressions of a worldview which is completely antagonistic to this Eurocentric viewpoint, and its counterpart, as you'll see, in the East. But one particular specific example of this is perhaps the Tablet of Wisdom of Baha'u'llah. When you read Tablet of Wisdom, Baha'u'llah is talking about, in a sense, history of philosophy. And a very important point that immediately becomes apparent reading Tablet of Wisdom is that Baha'u'llah is identifying Greek philosophy and Greek culture as part of the East, not as part of the West. In the discussion of Baha'u'llah in Tablet of Wisdom, he makes a distinction between the modern West and its technology and the advancement of its technology, which has become to a significant degree materialistic and has forgotten spiritual values, and contrast that to the Greek and Egyptian philosophy. And the Greek and Egyptian philosophy become embodiment of affirmation of spiritual principles, which has been the case in the past. And so the opposition that Baha'u'llah is proposing is between a materialistic Western culture and technology and an Eastern, which includes this Eastern conception, of course, the Greek and the Egyptian spiritual orientation and the rationality and the like. This is very interesting because, and of course, historically, this is what is accurate. In the time of the past, the Greek society and Greek culture was part of the Egyptian, African, Iranian culture, and these cultures were part of the same universe, cultural universe, and they had lots of interactions with each other, lots of mutual learning from each other. Abdu'l-Bahá has even talked about the mutual influence of the Greek culture and Jewish culture of the East. So one other thing that is very interesting for me is that while, as you'll see very soon, the Iranian intellectuals, philosophers in 1960s and 1970s of Iran were emphasizing this contradiction between the Greek culture and the East, including Islam, I'll come back to this and you'll see that the basic idea of intellectual discourse at this time becomes the contradiction between the two, just like the Eurocentric perspective. You see a Baha'i philosopher who is a professor in University of Tehran, the most prestigious intellectual center in Iran. His name was Dr. Dawoodi. And of course, he was the secretary of National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of Iran. In a sense, he was the leader of the Baha'i community. If you want to have an individual as a leader, it becomes the secretary of the National Spiritual Assembly. And whenever he discussed the question of West and the East and history of philosophy and so on, for example, in one of his talks, with the title Falsafe Sharq, Eastern Philosophy. Something that he begins with and emphasizes all the time is that the Greek philosophy is part of this East, part of the East. And the Greek culture and Greek philosophy and so on is an inseparable part of this Eastern universe of discourse. You see that in the Tablet of Wisdom, already there is this idea. That assumed historical identity and a static nature of the culture. The West has always been, from the times of the Greeks to the present, a particular culture, culture of rationality and so on. Of course, that is not accurate. The Greek culture was part of the East, and it came to the West really later on through, to a large extent, Muslims and crusaders and the like. So those assumed historical identities and so on are always illusions. But Baha'u'llah in the Tablet of Wisdom also emphasizes one very important other thing, and that's when he talks about development of philosophy and creativity in philosophy, he says that different cultures, different lands at different times become center of development and creativity in sciences, in philosophy, and so on. And he says that it would be for a particular period of time, and after that it would move to some other place and some other culture and so on. In other words, in the worldview of Baha'u'llah, any racist conception of these unitary cultures, which because of a particular racial concept, they are creative and they are rational as opposed to the others who are irrational, and so on, all these static conceptions are destroyed, and the question of cultural creativity becomes a sociological, historical question which moves from place to place and so on, has nothing to do with any particular biology or particular group of people or... And his example is, again, the Greek, that Greece was once a center of philosophical, scientific, artistic development and creativity, but then that age was over and it went to other places and so on. You can already actually see that in the writings of Baha'u'llah and then, of course, in the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, the most important issue is that East and the West and all different cultures and so on should learn from each other. And learning from each other and having communication with each other, mutual influence, mutual contribution, mutual dialogue and so on, that is what is defined as good, as the basis of creativity and so on. When Abdu'l-Bahá discusses Islam, he talks about a particular period of creativity in Islamic civilization. That particular stage of creativity in Islamic civilization happens to be the time that Islam became a vehicle for communication and interaction and dialogue among different civilizations. Iranian civilization and the Greek and the Egyptians and so on, they all became part of the same universe of discourse, interacted, and through this dialogue, mutual learning, sharing, and so on, a new creative civilization came into existence. It is not, from the point of view of Baha'u'llah or Abdu'l-Bahá, that a culture isolates itself and stops communicating with other cultures, sees the other cultures as strangers and as evil and as enemy, and always says that we have to go back to our own past and learning or having interaction with any other culture and so on becomes something evil and the source of all problems and so on. For the Baha'i Faith is the exact opposite. The culture of communication becomes the culture of rationality and creativity and so on. That is the essence of Abdu'l-Bahá's worldview. And so it is unity of the East and the West and the interaction of the East and the West and so on, which becomes the key for solution of varieties of problems for the East and for the West. But this particular insight, which if you are not brainwashed already by lots of ideological discourse, you immediately understand it. It makes sense. Of course, that's the only very intuitively accurate way of looking at the world. Unfortunately, has been concealed and has been distorted and has been hidden from the cultural discourse and lots of intellectual systems of thought, ideological systems of thought, both in the West and in the East. The famous idea of the clash of civilizations that you are all familiar with, which Huntington made that a very famous concept, although what Huntington says is not as bad as normally it is assumed to be, usually it's a straw man which is created out of Huntington. And his discussions are a bit more sophisticated than what people normally assume it to be. But in general, Huntington's viewpoint, Clash of Civilization, basically says that the age of communism versus capitalism is over, now that Cold War is over, and therefore he says the present and the future becomes the war and battle of different civilizations, different cultures, primarily represented by their religious worldviews and so on. And he sees these cultures as antagonistic to each other. Again, they have their own unity, their own logic, and they are opposed to each other. And the necessary result of this, again, is conflict and violence and so on. It's a milder re-emergence of that same Eurocentric idea without much overt racist elements, but the basic worldview has resemblance to that particular worldview. Okay, now I want to go to the case to the East, and in this case to Iran. I emphasize the case of Iran because the writings of Baha'u'llah, the writings of the Bab, writings of Abdu'l-Bahá have paid a special attention to the case of Iran. And although the writings of these sacred figures have been for the entire world, and Baha'u'llah is a reformer of the entire world, but coming from Iran, there has been very specific pronouncements and guidance and discussions and discourse about social, cultural, political issues in relation to Iran. And Abdu'l-Bahá was constantly in touch with the question of developments within Iran. Many of his earlier writings are directly political discourse on Iran. If Baha'is think that we do not get involved in any form of political discussion or political discourse and so on, Abdu'l-Bahá was always completely violating this principle. All his writings, all his early writings are directly political discourse, from his Secret of Divine Civilization that he writes in order to discuss what is the way of development of Iran in relation to modernity and the West, to his Traveler's Narrative, which is a discourse again of the conditions which led to the development of the West and the conditions which led to the underdevelopment of Iran and the solutions for that. That is the discussion of Traveler's Narrative. Traveler's Narrative is normally understood as a book of history that Abdu'l-Bahá discusses the history of the Bab and Baha'u'llah. That is correct. It is history, but it is not a historical work. It's a sociological, political work. which uses this history in order to make a particular sociological political point. I'll come back to these things a little bit. Or his first work, really, after he became the center of covenant, when he became the leader of the Baha'i faith, the work that he wrote, the treatise on politics, Risale Siyasiye, written in 1893, really immediately after he became the leader of the Baha'i community. The entire discussion is history of Iran, the relation of church and state, and the idea that whenever church and state have become one and the same, or religious leaders, clerical caste have seriously interfered in and has led political decision making, the consequence has been catastrophe for Iran, and his emphasis that church and state must be separate from each other. It is in the context of Iran, although he's discussing a fundamental general principle. So you can see that his earlier writings are all directly discussions of what we call sociological theory and political philosophy, political theory. Questions of development, modernity, interactions, questions of colonialism and imperialism, really. And in addition to that, he was constantly involved in the issues of development of Iran, constantly. Introduction of modern schools in Iran, introduction of modern health and healthcare in Iran. These were issues that Abdu'l-Bahá was continuously pursuing it in terms of Iran, giving particular guidance and so on. And then, of course, there is the constitutional revolution. In one of the sessions, one of the last sessions, I might talk about that. He was directly involved and would be giving particular guidance, which became very different at different stages, primarily because he was looking at the situation, and the changes in situation required different strategies and different tactics and so on. And Abdu'l-Bahá changed accordingly those strategies because he was looking at and following the concrete development in Iranian society. So in any case, Iran has been always a unique case in terms of the Baha'i writing. So for that reason, I'll emphasize now the case of Iran, how in Iran the question of East and West was perceived and was understood. There are two main historic points in the modern history of Iran which are very critical periods. One is before the constitutional revolution, and the other one is before the Islamic revolution. We had two major revolutions. And in both time periods, the question of the West and the relation of the East and the West and the identity of the West, identity of the East, becomes the major issue. The major, almost the only political issue discussed, sociological issue, is this issue. Really, there is not much any other issue. In the case of the time before constitutional revolution, late 19th century, early 20th century, you see battle of two different worldviews. And one particular worldview believes that the West is nothing but materialism and atheism, and so it is against God. And Islam becomes the opposite of that. Iran becomes an Islamic society, and it represents Islam, represents godliness and a God-centered viewpoint. And the point is that these two are absolutely opposite of each other, have nothing in common with each other. And the central sociological principle is a tradition attributed to sacred figures of Islam, and تَشَبَّهَ بِقَوْمٍ فَهُوَ مِنْهُمْ. I don't remember how it is translated, but whoever becomes similar or assimilates to a culture, to a group of people, he becomes one of them. Namely, if you resemble another culture, another group, do things like they do, dress up like they do, or think like they do, you become one of them. And Abdu'l-Bahá in Secret of Divine Civilization refers to this particular tradition, because the clerical caste were obsessed with this idea. And the basic notion was that the Western infidels are completely a different thing, and the whole reality of that culture is defined in terms of its atheism and its rejection of God, versus Islam, which everything becomes defined in terms of submission to God. And the consequence of this was that no learning from, no resemblance to the Westerns is permitted. Everything in the West becomes evil. So nothing of modernity can be appropriated by Iran. Nothing. Its technique cannot be appropriated. Its social institutions or ideas of culture, of civilization, its conceptions of politics, of religion, nothing can be learned from the West. And any attempt at modernization of Iran becomes a betrayal of Islam, becomes nothing but becoming an infidel, becoming an atheist, becoming materialist. The major target of Secret of Divine Civilization actually is this idea. Everything that Abdu'l-Bahá writes is related to this question, but this particular issue is the heart of Secret of Divine Civilization, that he discusses that and rejects that in varieties of fashions. By the way, one of his examples is the Greek philosophy. It's very interesting. He says that Islam came in the beginning from Arabia, but then Muslims started to learn from Greek philosophy and took the categories and ideas of Greek philosophy and incorporated that within Islamic concepts and ideas, and therefore Islamic philosophy came into existence. Islamic philosophy is unthinkable without Plato and Aristotle and their varieties of, you know, philosophical categories and conceptions and so on. And Abdu'l-Bahá says that, but now these clerical people who are saying that we should not learn from the infidels and nothing with them and so on, these are the people that they, all learnings that they are so proud of and boast of and so on, are products of learning and mutual interaction and mutual influence from the non-Muslims, in this case, the Greeks and so on. But this is how easily they have forgotten. But again, you see that the concept of Greek culture is defined in a positive fashion. In Tablet of Wisdom, you remember how Baha'u'llah talks about Plato, how he talks about Socrates and a number of others. But Socrates and Plato, the way Baha'u'llah talks about these two, are, you know, absolute praise and glorification and so on. So instead of looking at the Greeks as, you know, the opposite of spirituality and religion and Islam and East and whatever, it becomes one of the greatest aspects, one of the most proudest moments of the Eastern culture. In any case, there were, of course, at that time, another group of people. These were the people who loved the West and modernity of the West, and they hated Islam. And they argued that we are backward because of Islam, we have to get rid of Islam and completely imitate the West. Everything about the West is good. West is a one totality, you cannot choose. You have to accept the entire thing. And so people like Akhundzadeh, for example, even Agha Khan Kermani to some extent, who was a Babi Azali, and even Malcolm Khan, although he pretended that he's a good Muslim, even say that Jamaluddin Asadabadi or Afghani, who pretended that he's such a good devoted Muslim and so on. In reality, none of them seemed to have any real belief, and they had praise for the West, and so the East has to completely appropriate the West and imitate the West, and that was the solution. The Secret of Divine Civilization, like other works of Abdu'l-Bahá, and of course when Abdu'l-Bahá comes to the West and gives talks in Europe, America, and so on, he constantly deals with the question of the East and the West. And he has a very different point of view. There are good things about the West, there are good things about the East, there are evil things about the West, there are evil things about the East, and both can learn from each other, and both should interact and try to learn positive things from each other and move towards a culture which is neither Eastern nor Western. Beyond that, in a new form of cultural discourse, which is based upon unity in diversity, which is based upon a universalistic global orientation, but rooted in the principle of unity in diversity. But more important than that time period for me is the political sociological discourse in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. This time, theoretical political discourse becomes much more sophisticated. People now are university professors, intellectuals who are familiar with lots of sociological, philosophical ideas in the West. So they write in a much more conscious, sophisticated way. This is 1960s and 1970s. And before I really do a serious research on that, I could never understand what happened in Iran. Because apparently people in Iran were looking for democracy, they were tired of dictatorship and so on, so they made a revolution. But the revolution ended up to be an affirmation of both political and religious forms of despotism. And this is a big puzzle. But a very important part of answer to this, to why it happened and why these things happen in this way, is to look at the content of sociological and political discourse, intellectual discourse during the 1960s and 1970s of Iran. When you do that, then you realize that this was not an accident, nor it was a product of that at the last moment Iranians were deceived. It was a deep-rooted philosophical, cultural point of view which was dominant among the intellectuals and, of course, affected the people as well. So, how should I summarize in a very meaningful but at the same time concise, brief fashion this intellectual discourse of 1960s and 1970s? Well, the major point again was the opposition of the East and the West. The entire sociological political discourse became East versus the West, modernity versus Iran, and at the same time the West became colonialism and imperialism. So the whole question was also battle against colonialism and imperialism. But colonialism and imperialism also meant West and identical with the West. The whole discourse was West and East. And the basic idea was that the West is a monolithic entity. It has a unity. And all this unity, in principle, is evil. And it is completely opposed to the truth of the identity of Iranians. And the truth and identity of Iranians was defined in terms of Islam. And so political discussion meant that we have to reject the West because it is completely evil. And therefore we have to go back to our own roots, to our own true self, true identity, true culture. And that became defined as Islam increasingly. And of course, always representative of that becomes the clerical groups. And that always meant affirmation of support and institutionalization of the support for the clerical groups. The father of all these discussions was a university professor in Tehran University by the name Fardid. Fardid was a name that he gave to himself. His name is something else, but everybody knows him as Fardid. And what he discussed was primarily the idea that he created a word called Qarbzadegi, namely you are plagued by the West, or you are intoxicated by the West, or you are struck by the West. Occidentosis, the different translation of this term. It's a disease, really, that you become sort of possessed and you are not yourself anymore. Plagued by the West would be a good expression of that. And this became a very popular concept during the 1960s and 70s in Iran, but in this particular person, his name is Fardid, this has a very unique meaning. The issue of being plagued by the West, was not a recent phenomenon in the history of Iran. It is something which has 2,500 years history. In other words, for him, being plagued by the West means being plagued by Greek culture, by the cult of reason, by the idea of the sanctity of the human reason. So, according to him, the West is defined by Greek culture, again like that Eurocentric idea, and it is represented by the culture of reason. Opposed to that becomes Islam, becomes East represented by Islam. And in Islam, what you have is submission to the will of God. No reason, no relevance of reason. And his basic point is that Greek culture and culture of rationality, culture of the West, substitutes human being in place of God. So he says that any culture of reason comes and takes human being, rejects God, and puts human being in place of God. So, for instance, human being becomes legislator. Democracy, for example, democracy becomes a Western idea, because in democracy, human beings legislate what they should do. Politics and society, they decide. Human mind, human reason decides, not God. And of course, it is the essence of everything which is which is evil. So, and he uses all these Islamic words in order to discuss these philosophical ideas. So, the dominant sovereignty of reason, the positive conception of human being, becomes what he calls nafse ammare, namely the soul which is commanding to evil, the desiring soul, I think the Guardian has translated it as insisting soul. In any case, the whole culture of reason, culture of, you know, sacredness of human being, culture of human rights, culture of democracy, culture of equality of human beings, all these things becomes realization of the Greek culture and the revolt of human being against God. And the alternative to that is blind, absolute submission to God. When the self is completely eliminated and becomes just passive reflection and obedience to the will of God. So for him, this becomes Qarbzadegi. And so, for example, in the history of Islam, he finds Islamic philosophers like Avicenna, Averroes, you know, these very interesting figures, he finds them Qarbzade, namely plagued by the West, because they were influenced by Greek culture. He thinks they corrupted Islam. And so his task is that we purify Islam, we go back to our origin, which is an Islam without any of these notions of rationality, Greek influence and the like, pure submission to God, in which it is only God who decides and legislates and so on, not human being. Human being just passively follows and so on. And he thinks that this is mysticism and this is affirmation of God and religiosity and good and so on. And he finds one philosopher in the West that he thinks says the same thing that he thinks he is saying, and that's Heidegger. So, although he rejects everything Western and says that West is evil and bad, because he feels inferior to the West, all of them did. For that reason, in order to hide that and deal with that, he finds one very prominent Western philosopher that he says that he is actually in reality a Shia Muslim, but he is in disguise and he is dissimulating and so on. Now he forgets about the admiration of Heidegger for Greek philosophy. The whole cult of Heidegger was to look at the words, the Greek words, philosophical words, and elaborate them and show that how they portray actually the truth of philosophical issues. But Heidegger is not an issue, an image of Heidegger that he creates. And these ideas of this Fardid, more than anybody else, influenced the intellectuals of Iran, the future Iranian philosophers during 1960s and 70s were reflecting the same idea in different forms and shapes. Three particular alternatives emerge. I mentioned this and then I go back, say a few words about Abdu'l-Bahá and finish this discussion. Three particular viewpoints in terms of the specifics of the relation of East and West emerged during 1960s and 70s in Iran. One view represented by a person, his name is Ali Ahmad, very famous and very influential, who wrote a book called Qarb-Zadegi, that same term. He learned this term from Fardid. But for him, Qarb-Zadegi is more a recent phenomenon, a few hundred years. And his basic point is that the West is defined in terms of machine, technology, machine. He uses the word machine. And East is defined as dominated by the machine. Machine that is not created, is not made, is not constructed in Iran, is being used in Iran and it dominates Iranians and so on. So West is one thing and that thing becomes Western technology really, Western technique, which becomes all evil. And rejection of that completely becomes the solution. We have to completely reject the West and rediscover our original truth, which somehow it becomes the clerics. He finds the clerics the last obstacle against the dominance of the West. The second viewpoint is represented by perhaps the most influential author of the time, speaker of the time during the late 60s, early 70s. His name is Dr. Shariati. And Dr. Shariati made a distinction between, in terms of the West, between the technique of the West and the culture of the West. If you read, for instance, his book, Ma wa Iqbal, We and Iqbal, he praises Iqbal so much, Iqbal Lahuri, as really the reformer of Islam, and he's not aware that Iqbal praises the Bab and Baha'u'llah as the highest expression of Iranian and Islamic civilization, the highest creativity of the moment. Either he didn't know or he didn't want to know. And it's interesting, in that same passage that he's praising Iqbal, he says something negative about the Bab. All of them are like that. But in any case, For Shariati, he says that the technique of the West is good, it's not bad, but its culture is bad. So we have to appropriate the technique, but completely reject everything else about the West, because it's all cultures, institutions, and so on are corrupt and evil, and so on. And we have to reject that. Technique is okay, is good, we can adopt that, but nothing else. And he defines that as culture, culture and institution, farhang. And the third perspective is by the more loyal students of Fardid. They basically argue that technique is not important. Technique is an expression of a culture. And that culture, they call it nihilism. They say, therefore, the West is one thing. The entire West, all of them, is a one monolithic entity. It's a spirit. It's something. And that is nihilism. And it is completely opposed to Iran, to East, and to Islam. This binary opposition becomes. And the idea of nihilism again becomes the idea that God is rejected from the universe, therefore it becomes just material, an atheistic worldview, a mechanical worldview, and because of that, then nothing sacred can remain, none of the values can become valid anymore, and the result is a nothingness of anything, absolute relativism and absolute interest in anything, and so everything pathological follows. Opposed to nihilism becomes the idea that the universe is governed by God, by a creator, and that human beings are guided by God and submit to the will of God, and this becomes something which gives meaning to life and society, and it is good, and therefore the West becomes absolutely evil, the East, represented by Islam, becomes absolutely good, and we have to follow this, reject that. And in this understanding, Qalb Zadegi, that being plagued by the West, really means that we do not know the West, because we do not know what the West is, and we do not know what the East is, therefore we praise it so much, we are infatuated with it. But if we know what it is, which is nothing but nihilism, then we understand how evil it is, and how corrupt it is, and we reject it, and go back to what, which is the truth, which is our own culture and so on. These are the ideas, these are the dominant ideas. These are not examples of a few crazy minds. These are the dominant ideas of 60s and 70s. Even the left, some of these are left. Dr. Shariati is a Marxist who makes an is Marxist interpretation of Islam. Ali Ahmad, I mentioned, he's a Marxist. Again, a Muslim, but he makes them both distorted by their unity. But also the people who were definitely, you know, Marxist without any direct religious background and so on, like Tabari, they write in very similar fashions. For them also, the only question is battle against colonialism and imperialism. That means battle against the West. And so the whole question of good or bad means whether you are rejecting the West or not. Nothing else matters. And so this Tabari, for instance, which is the greatest intellectual, Marxist intellectual of the time, has written extensively against the Baha'is. And the point that he has in common with Shariati and Ali Ahmad, I'll say this and I start Abdu'l-Bahá briefly. One point that all the three have in common in criticizing the Baha'i faith is that they say that Baha'i faith rejects ta'assub, what we normally say is prejudice. And he said, they all say, Shariati says that, the Marxist Ihsan Tabari says that, and Ali Ahmad says that. Long time before that, Khomeini has said this. All of them have this common idea, that they praise, and before all of them, not discussing the Baha'i faith, but indirectly, Jamal Jamaluddin Asadabadi or Al-Afghani has said the same thing. They all praise prejudice, ta'assub, religious prejudice and national prejudice. And they say that prejudice makes you strong and makes you a warrior. And so you defend your group against the other groups and so on. And therefore, to view your group and your ideology as superior to the others, they believe that this is really what is revolutionary and what is progressive and so on. And so because the Baha'is constantly talk, and you know Abdul Baha constantly talks about rejection of all kinds of prejudices, tarkat asubat of all kinds. So they find the Baha'i faith as not progressive or something like that. This is 1960s and 1970s of Iran. It is interesting that one of the things that all of them, including Tabari, the Marxist member, leader of the Tudeh party, say about this prejudice, says that when you don't believe in prejudice, it makes you coward. You are not brave, and criticize the Baha'is. It's interesting that after the Islamic Revolution, the moment that the power was in the hands of the clerical groups, and they imprisoned this Tabari, immediately his bravery, because he had so much prejudice, became apparent. Immediately he recanted and came to the TV and announced that he is a spy of Soviet Union and the colonialism of the West, wrote books and articles dealing with that, and to the end, he continued to say the same things, never said anything else. This is the bravery and the courage that he's talking about. And then, of course, the Baha'is, because they don't believe in prejudice, including religious prejudice, they had no courage. That's why they took, tortured, imprisoned, confiscated all their belongings, and they gave them the option to say that I'm not a Baha'i, I'm a Muslim, or you would be killed. Majority of them, in a miraculous fashion, which is really, sociologically speaking, is one of the miracles of the modern history, that they chose, like that Dr. Dawoodi, for example, that university professor who was talking about culture of East and West in a very different fashions, and talking about rejection of the principle of prejudice. These people were the essence of courage and bravery. But their courage and bravery came from their fundamental principle of this universal love for humanity, not out of prejudice. And of course, when you support prejudice, you support all kinds of oppressions, and it is the essence of politically what is called colonialism and imperialism. But anyway, now I want to talk for maybe 10 minutes, no, 5 minutes, something like that, briefly about Abdul Baha and his position on this relation of East and the West. And I emphasize these things because you can see that the Baha'i discourse, even in Iran of 1960s and 70s, despite the appearance that the Baha'is are a group of citizens who are very quiet, who are not involved in directly terroristic activities or political challenges in the form of giving slogans and so on, but you can see how incredibly revolutionary and progressive they are when you put that in the context of the dominant social political discourse of the time. I give you just one example because the discussion of Abdul Baha requires much more time than what I have. But one of the greatest expressions of the mind of Abdul Baha I'll share with you. Because I talked about ta'assub, prejudice, right now, I'll emphasize on that point. Abdul Baha, you are familiar with the idea that he criticized the West, but he praised the West as well. This was like Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah praised the West, but criticized the West. This was always the case. And one of the defining features of Baha'i political, sociological, cultural discourse always is this, that they don't reduce the West to one thing and the East to one thing, and it is absolutely good or evil. There is no such a thing, which is sociologically and historically the only accurate viewpoint. But Abdu'l-Bahá defines in his writings the root cause of the problems in the world as in terms of a Western concept, namely the principle of a struggle for existence, the philosophy of a struggle for existence, tanazu'e baqa. In other words, some sort of philosophical Darwinism, not Darwinism as a biological scientific theory, but as a philosophical, metaphysical, sociological question. Sometimes it is called social Darwinism, but social Darwinism has very, very limited meanings. What Abdu'l-Bahá is talking about is much broader than that. The idea of a struggle for existence is a philosophical attitude which looks at human society like a jungle, that different groups within the societies are enemies of each other, and the survival of each one is dependent on combating and destroying the other group. War is the necessary condition of this natural existence as a jungle, and the only means of progress is violence and war and elimination of the weak. Now, one of the most miraculous things that Abdu'l-Bahá has said, and I'm always amazed by profound character of this viewpoint, Abdu'l-Bahá in his writings frequently, not once, a number of times, he discusses that what gives rise to a philosophy of struggle for existence in human societies is the principle of ta'assub, prejudice. He says prejudice in human societies is the equivalent of the principle of struggle for existence within the level of nature. Within the level of nature, we have a struggle for existence going on in different ways, but within the level of culture, within the realm of human beings and their institutions and so on, equivalent of that becomes principle of prejudice. So he says that prejudice leads to the dominance of this viewpoint of struggle for existence. And that, of course, he says, leads to all kinds of injustice and oppression and war and violence and the like. This is his phenomenology of violence and oppression and injustice and so on. But you can see that instead of now the question of Darwinism, which becomes materialistic philosophy, the idea of reducing human beings not as spiritual entities, but as biological entity within the jungle, looking at human beings as animals. That's basically the idea. Dehumanization of human beings and defining human beings as just these biological, materialistic, mechanical entities. But it is interesting that Abdu'l-Bahá defines this phenomena as product of and as expression of the principle of ta'assub, prejudice. Ta'assub, of course, is more complex than this word prejudice. I don't have time to discuss that. Prejudice is a particular viewpoint that you have about things that happen, about different groups and so on. Your judgment becomes inaccurate because of that. But ta'assub, as Abdu'l-Bahá discusses, is based upon this prejudice is rooted in a particular form of identification. Namely, you reduce your identity to one group, and then you see yourself superior to other groups, and you see the other groups, therefore, as enemies and as strangers. This is the source of that theoretical prejudice that you are going to have in understanding others and so on. So the concept of ta'assub, as Abdu'l-Bahá discusses that, is a much more complex entity. It's a particularistic identity which reduces the identity to that group, as opposed to and defining contrast and opposition to the other groups. And this causes you not to be able to see the reality in an impartial fashion and to make judgments in inaccurate and repressive fashion. But for Abdu'l-Bahá, social Darwinism or Darwinistic philosophy and so on, reduction of human beings to the level of material entity, takes place through ta'assub. And this ta'assub is of different kinds. It's national, religious, and the like. Which means that from the point of view of Abdu'l-Bahá, it is not just the West which is materialistic. The so-called East, which was supposed to be in these discourses of all these discussions prior to constitutional revolution during the entire 1960s and 70s, the East and the Islamic world, which was supposed to be expressions of godliness, the opposite of materiality, the opposite of nihilism, the opposite of nafs ammare and all those things that I shared with you. From the point of view of Abdu'l-Bahá, the East, the religious superstitions and culture of the East, of Iran, is equally materialistic and atheistic, namely social Darwinistic, namely reducing humans to the level of objects, animals, and destroying and eliminating any sense of a spirit, any sense of godliness, any sense of a spiritual definition of reality. Because it is the prejudice, and of course the most important prejudice here is religious prejudice. Once you have religious fanaticism and prejudice, which is the essence of all these ideas that I shared with you, that all they boast and they are so proud that they are prejudiced, and they criticize the Baha'is and Baha'i faith because the Baha'i faith is not prejudice and says elimination of prejudice. So they have so much pride in having prejudice. From the point of view of Abdu'l-Bahá, these prejudices and religious fanaticism in particular that Baha'u'lláh says in Epistle to the Son of the Wolf, that religious fanaticism is a world-consuming fire. Remember that? Defines religious fanaticism as a world-consuming fire. But you see that literally this has happened and is happening in the world. So from the point of view of Baha'u'lláh and Abdu'l-Bahá, instead of having this opposition, this meaningless, really, shallow opposition between East and the West, namely rejection of God and so much spirituality and godliness, for him, rejection of God, rejection of a spirit, means culture of seeing the world and human beings as a jungle and the violence of a struggle for existence being the regulating principle and basis of values and politics and so on, which is rooted in every kind of prejudice, including religious prejudices. In other words, the meaning of that is that for Abdu'l-Bahá, as much as the West is irreligious and unspiritual and is materialistic and it has to be criticized for that same reason, the East also, in many situations, in many ways, is equally anti-God and anti-spirit and anti-religious and anti-this. That is why Baha'u'llah emphasized so much that religion should be a cause of love and unity and peace and accord and so on. And if it is not, it is better not to have a religion. Because for him, many things in the name of God and in the name of religion, the only thing that they do is to encourage a culture of hatred and violence and discrimination of the rights of varieties of groups of people and suppression of anything which is spirit. So suddenly, the whole idea of East and the West take a very different set of dimensions. And what is good for the world is that both East and the West should go beyond this culture of social Darwinism. and should go towards a culture of communication in which they see the entire human race as one, and they see beauty in the East, they see beauty in the West, they learn from each other, but at the same time find lots of ugly things in all cultures and reject them. And you see that Abdu'l-Bahá makes a distinction between diversity, which he says is good, versus hostility and discrimination, which he says is bad. Remember, he says differences are of two kinds. One kind he rejects when it becomes a cause of war and discrimination and murder of the others and the rights of the others. The other, he says, is diversity, and he says that is great. Like that garden, which has different flowers with different fragrances, different shapes, and so on, that is beautiful. But differences, which become differences of hostility, which becomes realization, institutionalization of the principle of social Darwinism, he says that is not acceptable. So let me finish this discussion by sharing with you a statement of Baha'u'llah, one of the tablets of Baha'u'llah. Discussion of the West in sometimes by Westerners, sometimes by great leftist Westerners, even right now. And of course by discussions in Iran and many other places in 1960s and 1970s, have been very shallow, reducing the West to just one thing. The fact is that the West consists of so many different things, and some of them are great contributions and achievements, some of them the opposite. The science and industry of the West potentially have been one of the greatest achievements of humanity. What Shariati called culture of the West, he says that technique is good, culture is bad. The cultural achievements of the West and institutions of the West, many of them have been greatest expressions of a spirit and dignity of human being as a spiritual reality. Culture of democracy, principles of equality of men and women, principle of separation of church and state, rejection and abolition of slavery as a philosophical worldview, as a sociological worldview, the emergence of the idea that humans as humans have rights, conception of human rights and individualism and so on. These are among some of the greatest achievements of humanity. And within these ideas, human being appears as a spiritual being. It is not that when you have reason, you have rejected God and substituted human being in place of God. God has created human being in his own image. And for that reason, realization of human being as a spiritual being, not as an enemy of God, but as a spiritual being, requires a new culture in which human being is defined as an active entity with rights, with freedom of conscience, with freedom of decision making, with democracy, with humanization of women, which were treated as animals and as objects, with rejection of slavery. Islam has not abolished slavery. Christianity has not abolished slavery. Judaism has not abolished slavery. So the question of realization of human beings as entities defined by reason, defined by communication, these sort of things, these are affirmation of human being as a spiritual principles, not rejection of that. In the viewpoint of these people, human being completely becomes an animal. And only blind submission to an authority external is the meaning of religion. Whereas religion means realization of the potentiality within human beings as a spiritual being, as a reflection of God, so that we discover those spiritual principles, the guidance of God, we discover it within our own self. And it becomes a voluntary expression of freedom, which takes the form of this universal love and regulating principle of life. So anyway, the West has technique, but also had lots of great institutions that has to be praised, just as Abdu'l-Bahá praised democracy, separation of church and state, defended them in discussion of Iran when he came here, and so many other things. But then there are two aspects of Western societies, cultures which are not positive, which has to be criticized. And both of them go back to that Darwinistic, materialistic philosophy. One becomes a nihilistic idea, namely values increasingly because of rejection of God and spiritual principles become arbitrary, and therefore absolutely relativistic increasingly, which have tension with those great principles of democracy, human rights, and so on. And the other thing, of course, is colonialism and imperialism. But the point about colonialism and imperialism is that it is philosophically the reflection of the fact that the Western ideas of human rights, democracy, equality, inalienable human rights, and so on, was only applied to the Western people. And it was rejected and denied for the rest of the world. That's why the philosophical principles of colonialism and imperialism becomes possible. In the fanatic discourse of the so-called East, existence of colonialism became justification of rejection of democracy and human rights, not realizing that colonialism and imperialism is because of failure of applying, of application, of realizing the principle of democracy and human rights, and not because of that. But in the simplistic discourse, colonialism becomes the West is democracy and human rights, therefore rejection of separation of church and state, for example, and therefore rejection of colonialism is rejection of all of them, becomes a proof that all of them are evil. It's the exact opposite. So if one really wants to reject colonialism and imperialism, has to affirm the culture of human rights. It is because of human rights and sanctity of all human beings that colonialism is false. This was the viewpoint of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá. So I share with you now a tablet of Baha'u'llah in which he is rejecting British colonialism and British imperialism. It is within this tablet, for example, that Baha'u'llah's typical statement that the world is one. He discusses that, but he discusses that as an evidence that why imperialism and colonialism is wrong, not the exact opposite. That Tabari and others always in Iran have said that because Baha'is love the entire world, therefore they don't love Iran, and therefore they are supporters of colonialism. Baha'u'llah says the exact opposite. And of course, philosophically, it is the exact opposite. When you have principle of ta'assub, of prejudice, that is justification of colonialism. You might not like to be colonized by that group, but you believe in colonialism. You want to colonize that other one. It is not rejection of colonialism, but rejection of the fact that you are defeated. It is the culture of equalities and sacredness of all human beings, which is a rejection of colonialism in as such, in principle. This tablet of Baha'u'llah that I share with you is written in September 20th of 1882. This is a very important time period. This is the time that the British Navy attacks Alexandria, Egypt, and invades Egypt and formally colonizes Egypt and they stay there for many decades, till middle of 20th century. And this is the formal beginning of colonization of the Middle East by the British. Baha'u'llah has written at this time many tablets. I'm sharing with you just one. And he's so explicit about denouncing British colonialism that it's just unbelievable. It's the same Baha'u'llah who praised democratic achievements of the British, who praised the idea that the British abolished, made it illegal, the traffic of slaves and slavery He praises those things. And at the same time, he makes criticisms like this. The tablet is addressed to Zain al-Mughrabin. So he says, "O Zain al-Mughrabin." These are all my own tentative translations. "The world is in great turmoil. The powerful ones, namely British, show no compassion to the weak. For example, where one person, namely the British sovereign, where one person to rule all over the earth, with only one village remaining outside of his dominion, he would conspire day and night to seize that village as well. Would that this enthusiasm and zeal would turn to other endeavors. Vast majority of wars," he's talking about invasion of Alexandria. Let me share with you the beginning of that tablet. The beginning of that tablet says, Baha'u'llah says, "Verily, that which was built in 1,000 years or more is destroyed. Verily, the deeds of Alexander, who built Alexandria and was thus named after him, have come to naught." He's talking about destruction of Alexandria and the British Navy's attack. So after he rejected the British invasion, he says, "Vast majority of wars," in this case, the British colonial war, "vast majority of wars in the world are waged out of mere corrupt desires, yet they are falsely attributed to religion, honor, and country. Religion and country bear witness to the falsehood of these people. Say, the world is but one country, and all are created by the same world." See, he takes these principles. These principles are proofs that colonial war and invasion is wrong. Do you follow what I'm? Then he says, "The essence of injustice," namely colonialism, "the essence of injustice claims to represent justice. A great country," namely Egypt, "for mere corrupt desires has been seized by the enemies," namely the British. "Today it is incumbent upon all the friends," the Baha'is, "to beseech God to assist the party that is ascribed to God," namely the Muslims. "Diverse countries of the world have arisen to mischief and in utmost tyranny have assaulted against the people of salvation," namely Muslims. So Baha'u'llah is asking Baha'is to pray for the victory and triumph of the Muslims against the British colonialism and British invasion and so on. It's not just one tablet which is revealed during this particular period of time. There are many, many of these tablets. Some of them in more milder forms and so on have been available before. But a number of these tablets which are so explicit, like the ones that I shared with you, are usually unknown. So you have now an idea of how the Baha'i faith looks at the West and looks at the East and what it sees as a problem. And the problem ultimately is that we humans, both in the East and in the West, have to move towards a new spiritual orientation. And the meaning of a spiritual orientation is to see not ourselves and not others as animals, as jungle. And therefore, in a culture that we see everyone as ultimately one and the same. So all these different cultures are different from each other, but the essence of all human beings is one and the same, which is the mirror of God, which is a reflection of God. We are all one and the same. This is one of the worst things that sociology and anthropology have done unintentionally. They have emphasized the differences between different cultures and societies, so it has created, for those who are not really familiar with any of these things, a little shallow reading of sociology or anthropology gives this idea that these different cultures are totally different from each other. They have nothing in common, as if these humans are different species, simply because they have different cultures and so on. They cannot understand each other, nothing in common, and so on. And so they are permanent strangers. For Baha'u'llah, all are human beings, regard the world as one human body, and he said that do not look at each other as strangers. That is the way the problem of East and West can be solved. And that was the message of Abdu'l-Bahá, the unity of the East and the West. I wanted to go, but then I remember there are maybe questions, and I have talked for a much longer time period than I wanted. Yes, Tony.
Enjoy what you have to say. I wonder if you think that this opposition between East and West is not just a matter of superior and inferior, or good and evil, or material versus godly and so on, but also, and especially from the point of view of Iran and the East, this kind of quest for the illusion of purity, the pure self, or the pure nation, the pure community, the pure religion, and so on. Abbas Amanat has pointed this out in Iranian opposition to the Baha'i faith, even among atheists and leftists and so on, that Baha'is are bad because they're messing up the, you know, the purity of the Iranian self, which is, you know, has to be one and undifferentiated and so on. And if that's an aspect, and also Baha'is, you know, looking at our own community, sometimes we insist on the purity of, you know, the community. There can't be anything wrong and so on. So I wonder if you have anything to say about that.
What you said is a different expression of almost everything that I mentioned, namely from the Baha'i point of view, the what really defines the reality is diversity of different cultures and necessity of mutual learning and sharing and communication. Perhaps no statement of Baha'u'llah is more distinctive about the Baha'i culture than, you know, have associate or have fellowship with all other groups. One place he says with different religions, one place he says with different communities. Sometimes he says adyan, sometimes he says aqwam. With all different groups, whether it is religious, cultural, ethnic, national, and so on. And
that still goes to the idea of
Najaf. Yes, exactly. So the question of an elimination of the notion of ritual impurity and so on becomes one of the most important expressions of that. So ultimately the point is whether human beings define themselves in the form of an identity which is defined in terms of opposition to the others, or whether an identity which is defined in terms of reciprocity with others, interaction with others. And normally, in the first conception, association with others, communication with others, having mutual influence with the others and so on is a polluting entity. And it also, these issues have different, sociologically different implications in terms of this important concept of honor. The question of honor becomes really the question of defining your identity in opposition to the other group and your willingness to kill and murder others. So honor killing, for example, becomes very important. And it's always also sexualized. Always patriarchy is part of and parcel of the same idea of looking at other groups as enemies and so on. And the question of pollution is always part of this. It is partly an aesthetic idea, really. Namely, when you have a worldview of identity in those ways, any form of diversity is defined as ugly. It irritates you, creates some sort of agitation, and you want to get rid of that. In the other alternative worldview, diversity is beautiful. And you see the sentiments of Abdu'l-Bahá when he talks about, he says, look at the horses or the birds. He says there are different colors. This one is black, this one is white. He says, but they don't see each other as enemies and strangers, and they are in such a lovely friendship. They have life and so on. And he says, look, these birds are far, far more intelligent and rational than these human beings who have taken these purely meaningless, for instance, physical science, color, and so on, and have turned that into science for ugliness, science for lack of or presence of rationality, pollution, and so on. So I believe that the entire conscious and unconscious sentiments of people also have to go through varieties of transformation, so that when we see diversity, we find it beautiful, and therefore we want to affirm it, we want to encourage it, rather than become mobilized to suppress it and find it as violation of God and good and beautiful, and so on. There is no doubt that this is the fundamental principle of the Baha'i faith. But of course, the Baha'i community consists of individuals who are partly influenced by Baha'i principles and culture, and partly influenced by selfish limitations, experiences, and non-Baha'i cultures, and so on. So we have to be, as Baha'is, also all the time vigilant that in our life and in our dealings with others, with Baha'is, with non-Baha'is, and so on, to become closer and closer to the culture and ideals of the Baha'i faith, and should not assume that simply because we say prejudice is bad, that means automatically that we as individual Baha'is do not have prejudice. And on the contrary, should become conscious of the distance that we have with Baha'i ideas, and therefore strive more and more to become closer. I love this definition of Abdu'l-Bahá. You know, Abdu'l-Bahá has given a definition of a Baha'i. I don't think this is translated. But he says, Baha'i is the one who tries day and night to progress, to advance in all different dimensions of existence. Namely, this constant attempt to improve yourself. The Baha'i is not defined as a person who is perfect and has everything good. You know, the definition of Baha'i, namely the perfect integration of all virtues and so on, that fits Abdu'l-Bahá only. But the Baha'i, as a Baha'i, is a person who is defined by this constant attempt at transcendence, constant attempt at self-reconstruction, as improvement, as moving more and more towards Baha'i ideas. It's not static, which means that we have to re-examine ourselves, as Baha'u'lláh has said in Hidden Words, that every day you have to re-examine yourself and you know, see what is. In any case, so as Baha'i community becomes a vehicle for creation of that unity of the East and the West, provided that within the Baha'i community also we move towards that ideal increasingly, and never take for granted that we also have to battle against varieties of limitations that we have. Yes.
Aside from the fact that we believe in diversity, are you, with your extensive reading and study of Abdu'l-Bahá and Baha'u'lláh's tablets, aware of any particular places where they may have spoken about the fallacy of the concept of white supremacy, which is such an evil in the Western world, and maybe to some extent in the Eastern world as well?
Well, I'm sure as you are very much aware of these in writings of Abdu'l-Bahá and in his talks, perhaps when he came to the West, no issue was more emphasized than rejection of the culture of racism existing in the West and in the United States of the time in particular. And one of the greatest expressions of that that I love very much is his discussion that because God created human being in his own image, for that reason, color of skin has nothing to do with the humanity of humans. Because God is not a material entity, doesn't have a body, let alone to have masculinity or femininity or to have color of white or yellow or black or anything like that. So because God has created us in his own image, that means that our truth, our identity, has nothing to do with the fact that we are a male or a female, or we are born in Iran, or we are born in Canada, or we are black or white or other things and so on. And he therefore argues that all these differences should be understood as diversity, which makes the human family and human community much more beautiful, but none of these things should be considered as something which defines the worth of human beings, the identity of the human beings, the social rights of human beings, and so on. On the contrary, once we define human beings as a spiritual reality, as the image of God, then humans, by virtue of their humanness, which means capacity for love, for consciousness, for reason, then they are all sacred and have rights. And so in very, very, very strong languages, in varieties of fashions and so on, he has discussed this. Guardian, as you know better than I do, in his particular addresses to United States, for example, the advent of divine justice, he constantly emphasizes that United States is not going to experience social justice, real development, real realization of potentialities of culture and so on, unless it deals with this most great challenge, the most great evil of the culture, and the culture of racism and so on. So these are all part of that ultimate rejection of culture of Darwinism, of tanazu'e baqa. So culture of racism, culture of patriarchy, culture of militaristic nationalism, culture of colonialism, culture of religious fanaticism and bigotry and so on, all of them are different expressions of that principle of Darwinistic conception. And all of them are equivalent to varieties of forms of ta'assub, of varieties of forms of prejudice, which for Abdu'l-Bahá and for Baha'u'lláh, elimination of that is the precondition for emergence of human beings as a spiritual reality. That is the meaning of being a spiritual for Baha'u'lláh. For Baha'u'lláh, for Abdu'l-Bahá, to be a spiritual doesn't mean that I constantly shout, I believe in God, and day and night, you know, I engage in various rituals of prayer and fasting, and yet my heart would be filled with hatred of this group and that group, and I do everything that I can to prevent equal rights for women, for different religious groups, for different national groups, find them impure, and things like that. So that is not religiosity. That is not a spirituality from the point of view of Baha'u'lláh and Abdu'l-Bahá. From the point of view of Abdu'l-Bahá, Baha'u'lláh, everything is defined in terms of love. That would be the topic of some of my talks next times. And in his first work, Commentary on the Tradition, I Was a Hidden Treasure, I Love to be Known, Therefore I Created the World to be Known, that is the first work of Abdu'l-Bahá. You see the central principle is love and the typology of love that he discusses. And everything becomes love. And God, spirituality and so on is defined, just as Jesus said, God is love. That is a spirituality, that is love. But when you have members of religious group engaged in rituals, varieties of rituals, but then trying to engage in varieties of forms of violence against others and so on, from a Baha'i point of view, that is not religion. And such religion, its non-existence is far better than atheism. In other words, for me, you know, many people in Scandinavian societies and many aspects of the institutions in Scandinavia, although apparently they are all so atheistic and don't believe in God and so on, are much, much, much more spiritual than most of the people and most institutions that I find in Afghanistan or in Saudi Arabia. I mean, they claim to be so religious and so on, but when I see the way human beings are treated, that is complete dehumanization of humans in many situations. But when I see that people care for social justice, they want to eliminate poverty, they care for universal peace, human rights, and so on, these are affirmation of spirit and spiritual principles. So that is one of the other reasons that I find so shallow these ideas that the West is non-religious, atheist, the East, we are good and godly and so on, and eliminate that and, you know, this sort of things. Baha'i Faith has a new definition of what it means to have religion and the meaning of religion. Yes. Touched a very important point. The main reason, in my judgment, that the Iranian revolution turned into an Islamic revolution and the consequences that it had was precisely this fact, namely the secular, even the Marxist leftist intellectuals, their ideology and their worldview became really shadows of the clerical worldview and the supporters of that and affirmation of that. This was very different in 1940s and 50s, which the clerics and the intellectuals were opposed to each other. They believed that, you know, this one believed that they are reactionary and vice versa, although they had one thing in common. Both of them opposed the Baha'i Faith, and both of them defined the Baha'i Faith as this other of Iranian society, as Tony was saying. That happened in the 40s and 50s. And the leftists defined the Baha'i Faith as this foreign entity, and the clerics forged all these things, like Confessions of Dalgoroki and so on, to say that Baha'i Faith is something foreign and so on. So on the Baha'i Faith, they agreed in 1940s and 50s. On other things, they were diametrically opposed to each other. And before that, in 1930s and 1920s, following the constitutional revolution of Iran, the secular intellectuals, in principle, were very much opposed to the clerical groups and found them reactionary and out of touch and very backward, and supported secularization policies, for instance, of Reza Shah. And that was one of the reasons that the clergy could not have so much overwhelming dominance in culture and politics. What happened in 1960s and 70s is that for the first time, the secular intellectuals of Iran, the leftist intellectuals of Iran, the university professors in varieties of form and fashion, they all come to the same worldview. The worldview becomes opposition of the East and the West. Sometimes this is defined as colonialism versus Iran. And this is the only thing which defines what is good and bad. So who is progressive? Progressive is the one who is anti-imperialist. And so the clerical groups become anti-imperialist, therefore they are progressive. Complete overlook of internal issues. This is the characteristics of this political discourse. Only the question of East versus West. But the question of, okay, what is happening inside Iran? What about the rights of different groups? What about democracy, separation of church and state, ritual impurity, the situation of women, complete control of all the details of life of the individuals, by the clerical groups and so on, nobody had any interest of these issues. They were perceived as irrelevant. The only thing which was relevant was battle of the East versus West, and because West now is completely evil, and the Marxists also did the same thing. Marxists used to be very complex, sophisticated, you know. But after Soviet Union had a particular interest, and the particular interest was opposition to the West. And in the Cold War, this becomes even much more institutionalized. So really the question of good or bad in terms of socialist politics became whether you are against the West, British, America, or not. Other issues became secondary, unimportant. And it was the same idea that the clerics had. Clerics in Iran, very early they discovered that if they focus on the issues which affect the life of people in society, they cannot win. They understood that the Baha'is are the progressive ones. They understood that the Baha'i ideals are the ones which match the time and is based upon equality and sanctity of all human groups, democracy and the like. And during the Constitutional Revolution and a few decades after that, they were the losing group. And they felt this. The secular intellectuals also were conscious of that. Baha'is increasingly were becoming popular. The solution that they found was another version of the same thing that the leftists by Soviet Union they did. Namely that they decided that the only way that they can be perceived as progressive in Iran is to completely ignore domestic issues, internal issues, and only concentrate on the question of the East versus the West, foreigners. And the foreigners become colonialism, and that is bad, and they are representing that, and they define the Baha'is as representing the West and its colonialism. So the opposite of the Baha'is become the Muslim clerics. By defining themselves as representative of Iranian nations against the foreign threat, the colonialism and imperialism, they started to create this impression among the people and increasing 60s and 70s among intellectuals that they are progressive. So when you read what these leftist Marxists are saying about these clerical groups who were talking and writing their works about domestic issues, about apostasy, that if somebody is Muslim, decides not to be Muslim, has to be killed, about democracy that they denounced as infidel entity, Western idea because only God can legislate, Quran should be the principle of decision making, about the rights of men and women, all of them rejected the voting right for women, all of them rejected land reform, which Baha'u'llah has emphasized that a long time ago. These were actually well known, but the leftists, the seculars and so on chose in different ways to define the only issue of political social discourse as the relation of the East and the West. Colonialism versus. So you are progressive if you are anti-West. And then nothing else matters. And of course, when you have this idea in different ways, then there is a particular mentality. It was a fusion of religion and politics, and it ended up in the worldview that we have. After that, of course, people now experience the impact of the new situation on the rights and events within the society. And so all those groups who were supporting the progressive ones, one by one, were eliminated, murdered, destroyed by that same by that same politics. And of course, then they changed their ideas. To be honest with you, intellectuals of Iran right now, outside of Iran and in Iran, after 170 years that the Baha'is were denounced, attacked, attributed to everything evil and so on. After 170 years, the dominant views, ideas of the intellectuals in Iran right now has become the same ideas that Baha'u'llah was advocating more than 100 years ago. The idea of separation of church and state, the idea of political democracy, the idea of equality of men and women, the idea of non-violence, and the like. You go and read the ideas of these dominant, very progressive reformist Iranian intellectuals from the left, from the even some of the religious reformers and so on. They all have come with the same ideas that Baha'u'llah and Baha'i faith were advocating it for so many years, who were being killed for advocating those ideas, who were defined as reactionaries during the revolution, Islamic revolution of Iran, because they had no ta'assub, because they had no prejudice, and therefore they are bad. But now they realize ta'assub is bad. Now they realize East and West are not so monolithic, that they should go beyond this idea of hostility of East and West. They have to learn from each other, have peaceful coexistence and things like that. It is very, very strange thing that after 170 years, Iranian intellectuals have come now exactly to the positions, to the point of Baha'u'llah. Unfortunately, most of them, they don't know that this is what has happened. They now, most of them, defend the rights of the Baha'is, and they don't want the Baha'is to be persecuted. But very, very few of them recognize that these ideas have been advocated by the Baha, by Baha'u'llah, by Abdul Baha, long time ago. Now, after all these things, they have come and reached. That's the irony of Iranian history of political discourse. Thank you very much.